Here the smooth, wide valley changes to a more uncertain path through the mountains, with the serrated peaks of the Pilot Range, described lushly, 5, by one writer as a great rolling rampart which plays fantastic tricks with the sunshine and shadow, and towards sunset assumes the tenderest tints of deep amethyst. There was no sunshine or amethyst now, only the luminous moon, very bright and large, and a black Davia two-lane road which seemed totally deserted. To the left of the moon, and slightly below it, was a particularly bright star, perhaps a planet, Betty Hill thought, because of its steady glow. Just south of Lancaster, the exact time she cannot remember, Betty was a little startled to notice that another star or planet, a bigger one, had appeared above the other. It had not been there, she was sure, when she looked before. But more curious was that the new celestial visitor clearly appeared to be getting bigger and brighter. For several moments she watched it, said nothing to her husband as he negotiated the driving through the mountains. Finally, when the strange light persisted, she nudged Barney, who slowed the car somewhat and looked out the right-hand side of the windshield to see it. "When I looked at it first," Barney Hill later said, "it didn't seem anything particularly unusual, except that we were fortunate enough to see a satellite. It had no doubt gone off its course, and it seemed to be going along the curvature of the Earth. It was quite a distance out, meaning it looked like a star, in motion." They drove on, glancing at the bright object frequently, finding it difficult to tell if the light itself were moving, or if the movement of the car were making it seem to move. The object would disappear behind trees, or a mountaintop, then reappear again as the obstruction was cleared. Delcy, the dog, was beginning to get slightly restless, and Betty mentioned that perhaps they should let her out and take advantage of the road stop to get a better look. Barney, an avid plane watcher who sometimes liked to take his two sons, from a former marriage, to watch Piper Cub seaplanes land and take off on Lake Winnipesaukee, agreed, and pulled the car over to the side of the road where there was reasonably unobstructed visibility. There were woods nearby, and Barney, a worrier at times, mentioned they might keep an eye out for bears, a distinct possibility in this part of the country. Betty, who seldom lets herself get concerned or emotional about anything, laughed his suggestion off, snapped the chain lead on Dilsey's collar, and walked her along the side of the road. At this moment, she noted that the star, or the light, or whatever it was in the September sky, was definitely moving. As Barney joined her on the road, she handed, 6, Dilsey's leash to him and went back to the car. She took from the front seat a pair of 7x50 crescent binoculars they had brought along for their holiday scenery, especially Niagara Falls, which Betty Hill had never seen before. Barney, noting that the light in the sky was moving, was now fully convinced that it was a straying satellite. Betty put the binoculars up to her eyes and focused carefully. What they both were about to see was to change their lives forever, and as some observers claim, change the course of the history of the world. The holiday trip had been a spontaneous idea, originating with Barney. For some time now, he had been assigned to the night shift at the Boston Post Office, where he worked as an assistant dispatcher. He liked the job, if not the hours and the long commuting drive from Portsmouth to Bowes Town each night, 60 miles each way. The commuting was especially exhausting, with no train or bus available at the late night hour he began work. The rigors of the daily 120-mile round trip had, Barney felt, been instrumental in causing his ulcer to kick up, a condition for which he was under medical treatment. He began thinking about the idea for the trip while he was driving into work on the evening of September 14, 1961. Betty had a week's vacation coming up, a badly needed one from her job as a child welfare worker for the state, handling a rather overwhelming caseload of 120 assignments at one time. With luck, Barney would be able to take some of his vacation leave and relieve some of the pressure while waiting for the results of some recent x-rays of his ulcer his doctor had taken. All during that night at work, the idea appealed to him more. It grew on him as he went through his usual routine, standing in front of some 40 clerks sorting mail, calling out numbers of towns or sections of the city of Boston. The clerks in turn would put the mail from designated slots onto a conveyor belt, where the mail handlers would carry the process on as the hampers moved to the elevators to be dispatched. Barney, with an IQ of nearly 140, could handle more complex jobs than this, but like so many post office workers, he found the frustration of routine work compensated for by the civil service advantages. Further, the steadiness of the job gave him ample time for his community service work, which, he felt, was both demanding and rewarding. He punched out at the Boston Post Office at 7:30 the following morning and drove toward Portsmouth in anticipation of surprising Betty. Just 7. The idea of getting away relaxed him. Though the harsh realities of the New Hampshire winter would soon be on them, the roads would be free and clearer now, and the traffic would be light, ideal for leisurely motoring. They planned their trip that morning over a cup of hot coffee, Betty accepting the idea at once. But trip money was not in the budget. Barney's main regret was that his two sons couldn't join them, for they both had made a pleasing adjustment to the second marriage, with mutual affection springing up spontaneously between boys and Betty, a condition that Barney whimsically attributed to Betty's expert cookery. The total adjustment to their mixed marriage had been remarkably smooth. Betty was as proud of her liberalism as she was of her long New England lineage. In my family, she once wrote in a theme, it seems to be a belief that the purpose of one's life is to bridge the gap between the past and the future. Over this bridge flows all the past, good or bad, to influence the future, and the future of the world depends upon the individuality and strength of the bridge. All through her family history, Betty points out, various members have fought for unpopular causes. The Dow branch of the family were Quakers in 1662, were attacked, beaten and driven out of Salisbury, Massachusetts, their property stolen and their homes burned. Just before the Civil War, they were active abolitionists, and were with John Greenleaf Whittier when his printing presses were burned by the townspeople of Amesbury, in the same state. The greatest day of my life, Betty once said, was when I learned to read. My days of boredom were over. She was a bright student in the one-room school that she attended in Kingston, New Hampshire. With one teacher for six grades, she was able to move ahead at her own rate. She see and remember explaining Longdivi Science to the fourth grader when she was in third, and won all of the contests, spell INGBs, dramatic roles and prizes there were to be had. An energetic KLD, sometimes troublesome, she worked on constant projects to earn money, pig ing cowslips, wild strawberries, R, as PBR rice and blue, berries, and selling them at a handsome profit. She was so voracious in her reading that her mother used to limit her to one book a day. When Betty was 11, at the height of the DEP recession, her mother threw away family tradition to work in a pharmacy. At first, it was to be a temporary measure, part-time. Betty's father, the breadwinner, has become ill, Saffing's haddwindled, and her mother's inheritance hardy been embezzled. But labor union organizers were moving into the New England mill towns, '8, and her mother, a lady of rigid New England gentility, became enthralled. She helped to organize, led strikes, and became a member of the union's executive board. Betty was proud of her mother, watching her on the picket lines, worried about the possibility of attack by hecklers or arrest by police. During this time, the family table groaned not with food, but with arguments between an uncle who was helping to organize the CIO in Lynn, a family friend who was carrying out the same chore in Lawrence, and Betty's mother who was strictly a F. of L. These were exciting scenes to young Betty, with the strikes, the elections and the celebrations. Her father, working for another uncle who owned a shoe factory, remained stoically neutral. Betty's experience with colored people was limited. Not too many lived in New Hampshire, but at an early age she lived across the street from an interracial couple and absorbed the snide remarks of her classmates against the colored wife. Later, Betty's mother impressed her by saying that although some people did not like colored people, this was wrong because they were people just like everyone else. If Betty heard anyone talking against them, she should speak up without hesitation. She did. As a sophomore at the University of New Hampshire, which Betty entered in 1937, a girl who was a Negro from Wilmington, Delaware, enrolled at the college to the consternation of both the administration and the students. In the late 30s, integration was a problem even in the northern state universities. Betty would find Anne, alone in the corner of the smoking room, ignored by the other students. Betty would say nothing at the time, but seethed underneath. When Anne would leave, the other girls would suggest caustically that Anne should go back where she came from, and Betty would react strongly. On one such occasion, as Anne was leaving the smoking room, Betty went to her, and in front of the others, asked to see her room. It was the beginning of acceptance for Anne, but not until after a long struggle. At times, Betty would almost physically restrain her from leaving the university. She fought with Anne to stop her from packing her luggage. Eventually, Anne graduated Phi Beta Kappa, went on to Harvard and now teaches on the faculty of a southern college. Although the roots of Betty Hill's marriage to Barney may lie in the attitude expressed by this incident, their problems as an interracial couple are minimal. Barney, at times, shows concern about rejection in public places, hotels, restaurants or meetings. But in their private social life they are popular, accepted, and almost overactive. Their initial self-conscious, nine, nest dissolved quickly. "It doesn't have any more meaning to me," Betty once told a friend, "than a person having blue eyes or brown eyes. Everyone wants to meet us, everybody wants to invite us places. We've even had to set up some kind of limits, or we would be going here, there, everywhere, constantly." The planning of the trip that was to have such a profound impact on their lives was brief and relaxed. The shortage of immediate funds was partially compensated for by Betty's idea of borrowing a car refrigerator from a friend. In this way, the expense of too many meals in restaurants would be reduced. Barney, momentarily ignoring the diet for his ulcers, drank a glass of orange juice, ate six strips of bacon and two soft-boiled eggs, as he plotted the course of the trip on a few Gulf Road maps. They would drive leisurely, avoiding the throughways, pay a brief visit to Niagara Falls, then circle through Montreal, and back to Portsmouth. While Betty shopped for food, Barney took a nap to recover from his all-night work at the Boston Post Office. They finished most of their packing that afternoon, filled the car refrigerator with food and put it in the deep freeze. By 8 o'clock that evening they were in bed with the alarm set for 4 the next morning. Barney, an inveterate early riser, was up first, but in moments Betty had coffee percolating, and the last-minute packing process began. As he loaded the trunk, Barney shoved a bag of bone meal fertilizer to one side, and packed the luggage around it. Betty Bad bought the fertilizer to work on the garden during the vacation. It was just as easy to let it stay in the trunk as to take it out. Later, they were to find this comfortably homey material creating an unusual inquiry and speculation. It was a clear, crisp New Hampshire morning as they drove off, noting the mileage on the speedometer only to lose the slip of paper later an ingrained habit of Barney's. They drove out Route 4, toward Concord, in a festive mood. Barney, at the wheel, burst into a hoarse version of "Oh, What a Beautiful Morning." Betty, who liked to hear Barney sing, smiled. Barney, who liked to please Betty, smiled back. There was no hint at all of what was about to happen later, nor could there be. No such event would be so thoroughly documented. 10. The object they saw in the sky near Route 3 4 nights later, south of Lancaster, New Hampshire, continued its unpredictable movement as they passed through Whitfield and the village of Twin Mountain. They stopped briefly several times, and by now Barney was frankly puzzled. His only alternate theory, aside from that of a satellite, was that the object was a star, a theory he immediately discounted because they had proved that it was in movement, changing its course in an erratic manner. At one of the stops, a few miles north of Cannon Mountain, Betty had said, "Barney, If you think that's a satellite, or a star, you're being absolutely ridiculous. With his naked eye, Barney could tell that she was right. It was obviously not a celestial object now, he was sure. We've made a mistake, Betty, he said. It's a commercial plane. Probably on its way to Canada. He got back in the car, and they continued driving on. Betty, in the passenger seat, kept it in view as they moved down Route 3. It seemed to her that it was getting bigger and brighter, and she kept getting more puzzled and more curious. Barney would note it through the windshield on occasion, but was more worried about a car coming around the now frequent curves of the road. His theory that it was a commercial airliner headed for Canada soothed his annoyance at the fact that he might be confronted with some unexplainable phenomenon. The road was completely deserted. They hadn't seen a car or truck in either direction for miles now, which left them alone in the deep gorges late at night. Some natives of northern New Hampshire prefer never to drive through these roads at night, through long-standing custom and superstition. In winter, an informal group known as the Blue Angels patrols the roads for cars frozen or broken down. It is too easy to freeze to death in these lonely stretches, and the state troopers cannot possibly cover the wide territory frequently enough. Barney, his concern growing in spite of his comforting theories, hoped that he would soon see a trooper or at least another car driving by which he could flag and compare notes with. Around 11 o'clock they approached the enormous and somber silhouette of Cannon Mountain, looming to the west on their right. Barney slowed the car down near a picnic turnout that commanded a wide view to the west and looked again at the strange moving light. In amazement, he noted that it swung suddenly from its northern flight pattern, turning to the west, then completing its turn and heading back, 11, directly toward them. Barney braked the car sharply, turning off into the picnic area. Whatever you're calling it, Barney, Betty said, I don't know why, because it's still up there. And it's still following us, and if anything it's coming right toward us. It's got to be a plane, Barney said. They were standing in the picnic area now, looking up at the light which was growing bigger still. A commercial liner, with a crazy course like that? Betty said. Well, then it's a Piper Cub. That's what it is. With some hunters, who might be lost. It's not the hunting season, Betty said, as Barney took the binoculars from her. And I don't hear a sound. Neither did Barney, although he desperately wanted to. It might be a helicopter, he said as he looked through the binoculars. He was sure that it wasn't, but was reaching for any kind of explanation which would make sense. The wind might be carrying the sound the other direction. There is no wind, Barney. Not tonight. You know that. Through the binoculars, Barney now made out a shape, like the fuselage of a plane. Although he could see no wings. There also seemed to be a blinking series of lights along the fuselage, or whatever it was, in an alternating pattern. When Betty took the glasses, the object passed in front of the moon, in silhouette. It appeared to be flashing thin pencils of different colored lights, rotating around an object which at that time appeared cigar-shaped. Just a moment before it had changed its speed from slow to fast. Then slowed down again as it crossed the face of the moon. The lights were flashing persistently, red, amber, green and blue. She turned to Barney, asking him to take another look. It's got to be a plane, Barney said. Maybe a military plane, a search plane. Maybe it's a plane that's lost. He was getting irritated at Betty now, or taking out his irritation on her because she was refusing to accept a natural explanation. At one time, several years before, in 1957, Betty's sister and family had described seeing clearly an unidentified flying object in Kingston, New Hampshire, where they lived. Betty, who had confidence in her sister's reliability and capacity for observation, believed the story of her sighting. Barney neither believed nor disbelieved. He was indifferent to the subject as a whole, had little interest in it. If anything, he was more skeptical, 12, of flying objects after hearing her story. He felt that Betty, for the first time in 5 years, was about to bring this subject up again. But she didn't mention it. Beside them, the dachshund was whining and cowering. Betty gave the binoculars to Barney, took Dulcie to the car and got in and shut the door. Barney put the glasses on the object again, again wishing that he could find some comfort from comparing notes with a passing motorist. He wanted above all to hear a sound, the throb of a propeller-driven plane or the whir of a jet. None came. For the first time, he felt he was being observed, that the object was actually coming closer and attempting to circle them. If it's a military craft, he was thinking, it should not do this, and his mind went back to a time a few years before when a jet had buzzed close by him, shattered the sound barrier, and cracked the air with an explosion. Getting back in the car, Barney mentioned to Betty that he thought the craft had seen them and was playing games with them. He tried not to let Betty know that he was afraid, something he didn't like to admit to himself. They drove on toward Cannon Mountain at not much more than 5 miles an hour, catching glimpses of the object as it moved erratically in the sky. At the top of the mountain, the only light they had seen for miles glowed like a beacon, appearing to be on top of the closed and silent aerial tramway, or perhaps on the restaurant there. They stopped again near the base of the mountain, momentarily, as the object suddenly swung behind the dark silhouette and disappeared. At the same moment, the light on the top of the mountain went out, inexplicably. Betty looked at her watch as it did so, wondering if the restaurant were closed. She could not read the dial very plainly in the dashboard light, and never did get an accurate reading. If there were people up there, she thought, they must be getting an exceptional view of the object. As the car moved by the darkened silhouette of the old man of the mountain, the object appeared again, gliding silently, leisurely, parallel to the car to the west of them, on the Vermont side of the car. It was more wooded here, more difficult to keep the object in sight as it glided behind the trees. But it was there, moving with them. Near the turnoff for the flume, a tourist attraction, they stopped again, almost got a sharp, clear look at it, but again the trees intervened. Just beyond the flume they passed a small motel, the first sign of life they had seen for many miles. The tidy hostelry looked comforting, although, 13, Barney, his eyes alternately moving between the curves of the road and the object in the sky, barely noticed it. Betty noted a sign, beaming with AAA approval, and the light in a single, lonely window. A man was standing in the doorway of one of the cottages, and Betty thought how easy it would be to end the whole situation right now by simply pulling into the motel. She was thinking this but she didn't say anything to Barney. Her curiosity about the object had now become overwhelming, and she was determined to see more of it. By now, Barney was beginning to irritate her by trying to deny the existence of the object. In fact, he was. He was still concerned about another car coming around a blind curve while he tried to keep one eye on the object as it moved around almost directly ahead of them on the road. It was now apparently only a few hundred feet high, and it was huge. Further off, it had seemed to Betty that it was spinning. Now it had stopped and the light pattern had changed from blinking, multicolored lights to a steady, white glow. In spite of the vibrations of the car, she put the binoculars to her eyes and looked again. She drew a quick, involuntary breath because she could clearly see a double row of windows. Without the glasses, it had appeared only as a streak of light. Now it was clear that this was a structured craft of enormous dimension, just how large she couldn't tell because both distance and altitude were hard to judge exactly. Then, slowly, a red light came out on the left side of the object, followed by a similar one on the right. "Barney," she said, "I don't know why you're trying not to look at this. Stop the car and look at it. I'll go away by the time I do that," Barney say I'd. He was not at all convinced that it would. "Barney, you've got to stop. You've never seen anything like this in your life, eh?" He looked through the windshield and could see it plainly now, not more than 200 feet in the air. He thought, and coming closer. A curve to the left in the road now shifted the object to the right of the car, but the distance remained the same. To the right, not far south of Indian Head, where another high historic stone face surveys the mountains and valleys, he saw two imitation commercial wigwams on the site of, a closed-down enterprise known as Natureland. Here, hundreds of youngsters swarm with their parents during summer visits. At this moment it was silent and tomb-like. J.L. Barney stopped the car almost in the center of the road, forgetting in the excitement any problem with other traffic. "All right, give me the binoculars," he said. Betty resented his tone. It sounded as if he were trying to humor her. Barney got out, the motor still running, and leaned his arm on the door of the car. By now the object had swung toward them and hovered silently in the air not more than a short city block away, not more than two treetops high. It was raked on an angle, and its full shape was apparent for the first time, that of a large glowing pancake. But the vibrations from the motor jostled his arm, blurring his vision. He stepped to one side of the car to get a better look. "Do you see it? Do you see it?" Betty said. For the first time her voice was rising in emotion. Barney, he admitted frankly later, was scared, perhaps as much because Betty rarely became excited as because of the nearness of this strange and utterly silent object defying almost any law of aerodynamics. "It's just a plane or something," he snapped at her. "Okay," Betty said. "It's a plane. But did you ever see a plane with two red lights? I always thought planes had one red and one green light." "Well, I can't get a good look at it," he said. The car was shaking the binoculars. Then he stepped a few feet away and looked again. As he did so, the huge object as wide in diameter as the distance between three telephone poles along the road, Barney later described it, swung in a silent arc directly across the road, not more than 100 feet from him. The double row of windows was now clear and obvious. Barney was fully gripped with fear now, but for a reason that he cannot yet explain, he found himself moving across the road on the driver's side of the car, onto the field, and across the field, directly toward it. Now the enormous disc was raked on an angle toward him. Two fin-like projections on either side were now sliding out further, each with a red light on it. The windows curved around the craft, around the perimeter of the thick, pancake-like disc, glowing with brilliant white light. There was still no sound. Shaken, but still finding an irresistible impulse to move closer to the craft, he continued on across the field, coming within 50 feet of it, as it dropped down to the height of a single tall tree. He did not estimate its size in feet, except that he knew it was as big or bigger in diameter than the length of a jet airliner. Back in the car, Betty was not at first aware that Barney was walking, 15, away from her. She was thinking that this wasn't a very smart place to park the car, in the middle of the highway, even though there were no curves nearby. The car was neither on the right nor the left, it was splitting the white dotted line down the middle of the road. She would watch, she thought, to see if any headlights appeared either in front of or to the rear of the car, and at least pull the CR quickly out of the way if another should appear on the road. She busied herself doing this for several moments, and then suddenly became aware that Barney had disappeared into the blackness of the field. Instinctively, she called for him. "Barney," she screamed. "Barney, you damn fool, come back here." If he didn't reappear in a moment, she resolved to go out after him. "Barney. What's wrong with you? Do you hear me?" There was no answer, and she started to slide across the front seat, toward the open door on the driver's side of the car. Out on the field, near a shuttered vegetable stand and a single, gnarled apple tree, Barney put the binoculars up to his eyes. Then he stopped very still. Behind the clearly structured windows he could see the figures, at least half a dozen living beings. They seemed to be bracing themselves against the transparent windows, as the craft tilted down toward his direction. They were, as a group, staring directly at him. He became vaguely aware that they were wearing uniforms. Betty, now nearly 200 feet away, was screaming at him from the car, but Barney has no recollection of hearing this. The binoculars seemed glued to his eyes. Then, on some invisible, inaudible signal, every member of the crew stepped back from the window toward a large panel a few feet behind the window line. Only one remained looking at him, apparently a leader. In the binoculars, Barney could see appendages in action among the apparent crew at what seemed to be a control board behind the windows of the craft. Slowly the craft descended lower, a few feet at a time. As the fins bearing the two red lights spread out further on the sides of the craft, an Ixton sign lowered from the underside, perhaps a ladder, he could not be sure. He sharpened the focus of the binoculars on the one face remaining at the window.